I'm Dr. Emily Silverman, and welcome to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. Join us as we explore the latest advances, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we sit down with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Anna Chodos. Anna is an associate professor at UCSF in the Division of Geriatrics and the Division of General Internal Medicine at Zuckerberg San Francisco General. She's the medical director of outpatient geriatrics at Zuckerberg General, which includes the Geriatrics Neurology Cognitive Clinic, where an interdisciplinary team evaluates patients for cognitive symptoms. Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So, Anna, I feel like geriatricians are some of my favorite doctors. They have such a holistic lens through which they see patients and medicine. And I was wondering if you could tell us about your journey to geriatrics. How did you land in this field?
I wish I had an aha moment. I really don't. It was a progressive exploration of the things that interested me in medicine once I figured out that's what I wanted to do. I first thought I was going to be interested in end-of-life care. It seemed really important, really under-addressed in society and life in general. And so I thought it was really interesting. And I did love it. I volunteered at a hospice for a while as a social visitor. But I realized I really just enjoyed spending time with older people and appreciated the perspective they had, the wisdom they had to share, and just talking to people at a different stage in life. I was also really fortunate to have wonderful role models throughout. So growing up, my main caregivers, it was a young couple, and one of them was studying to be a nurse and working on the side as a caregiver for older people. And I have to say, she just always modeled the most incredible respect and joy in her work. And it, I think, just put me on a path of seeing that as an avenue and something that might be really wonderful, as opposed to, let's just say, I think society in general doesn't always paint the loveliest picture of older people and people with progressive disabilities as they get older and people who need help. That's not something we tend to value or hold up. And then when I realized I just really loved medicine, like complexity and all the things that we get to do for people as physicians and help them with their health conditions, obviously that tends to be a big factor in older adult care. And then looking for mentors, I side with you that geriatricians tend to be really wonderful folks. And I found my community there. And just seeing the medicine they practice and the way they work with patients, it was just more and more for me. I think you just really have to focus on seeing the person. Their list of conditions and things isn't who they are. It's really the overlap of all those things. And there's no way to avoid that in geriatrics. And I think that's the other thing I really love, is we really need to know who our patient is and be able to see life from their perspective and then figure out how we're going to help them meet their goals and live the life they want to live at that point in their life.
So I imagine a lot of your patients are in their 70s, 80s, 90s, and above. How do you approach dementia in this population? Do you screen for it? Do you wait until you notice something? Do you wait until the families notice something? How does it usually bubble up?
We are at, I think, and I hope, a point in healthcare in general where we're starting to realize this needs to be a proactive approach to this condition. But in general, it is true. Most of my patients are older, although we do certainly see people with early onset or symptoms earlier in life. And as you know, Zuckerberg San Francisco General and the campus that we have with the clinics there, we really serve a safety net population. And people who have been historically underserved or are low income tend to have higher risk factors for dementia at earlier points in life. So I actually see people quite often in their 50s and early 60s who are starting to have symptoms. But in my general practice, I do screen. And the reason I screen is because there's so much we can do, and the earlier the better on many levels. One would just be to start to identify how we're going to support someone if they do have this condition and get that going as early, as proactively as possible. But also, we really do lose valuable time. The clock is ticking when it comes to supporting brain health. So we know that people who are more active, have less burden of certain medications, can hear. This is probably like numbers 1 through 10 of the interventions we could be doing more aggressively, but the hearing and making sure people can see, these are all really not hard things to do. I understand getting physically active can be hard for all of us with the lives that that we have going on, but this isn't a big fancy medical intervention is what I mean. And these make a huge, huge difference in terms of speed of progression. So I think as a society, investing in so many other ways to support and treat people with dementia, earlier detection and intervention is really urgent and key. So I do screen. And I also encourage my colleagues to screen. I do a lot of teaching to other providers, trainees. Actually, mostly I train other primary care providers in the community and across the state. And the goal there is to get them to feel like screening is doable.
You mentioned that it's important to detect dementia early, and you gave a few reasons, like interventions such as activity and making sure that they can hear and see. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, why is it just so important that we proactively detect this disease early?
Yes, it is so important that we detect early for many reasons. But really, I try to emphasize to my colleagues, the main reasons are that there's so much we can do. I think a lot of people experience, or at least I've heard from patients and their families or whoever their support system is, that they sort of were given a diagnosis or they were experiencing symptoms and not a lot was done for a long time. And to me, that's really a lost opportunity, because it turns out that there's many opportunities to really affect the progression of dementia early on. And I think most people would want that. Most people want to have more time with fewer symptoms and potentially less disability as they have dementia. We know we can't really cure it with these interventions, but we can really slow it down. And the one we know that has the biggest impact is correcting hearing. Either in middle age, when we get it, that affects for more people the risk of developing dementia, but also if people have dementia, there's very, very good evidence for two things. One, if we correct hearing, the progression slows down, and that we can adequately correct hearing. It doesn't have to be perfect all the time, and usually we can't. So if you talk to people with hearing aids, they're often less than thrilled with the hearing correction. But even some amount of correction part of the time is really helpful. And the way I think about it is it's just about inputs to the brain. It's a real use it or lose it phenomenon. And so hearing and seeing is just really, really important. I don't emphasize seeing as much because most people don't really mind correcting their vision and they're pretty proactive about that. But we want to make sure that's done too. The other one, and this is so important for my medical colleagues and I'm constantly emphasizing it, is making sure people aren't on medications that we know make dementia progress faster. And it's not intentional. These medications are out there for other wonderful reasons to treat symptoms from other things, but they do get into the brain and we know that they accelerate dementia progression. So for example, we really look for medications that have something called anticholinergic properties. You can Google anticholinergic burden and there's a list of medications that you can look through and see if you're on them and see if either the dose could be reduced or you could find a substitute medication that doesn't have those side effects. And then the other one is physical and social activity. And again, here we are thinking that these are separate from the brain, but of course, these are really brain health activities. So much to the chagrin of everybody who's trying to get more physical activity really is a very powerful brain health activity. And we don't really know why, but a lot of that probably has to do with blood flow and just general health. What is heart health is brain health. And then social activity. And this one is kind of funny because people always ask, like, what on earth do you mean? But it really means, like, what are the things that really engage your brain? What are the things you love to do, bring you joy? Who are the people you love to interact with? And this connects a little bit to the loneliness connection. That's not so much a emphasized risk factor, but more and more we are seeing that people who describe themselves as feeling lonely do progress faster with dementia. It's a risk factor for developing it in the first place. So These are potent brain health activities and mechanisms that we could be using that we really don't as much as we should.
When you're screening for dementia, do you have a tool that you use, or is it more just a general sense, or how do you screen?
Yeah, this is hard because there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of tools. People are always developing new tools. So it gets really confusing for all of us in the medical profession. Like, what's the one I'm supposed to use? And the answer is simple and not simple. The answer is you really have to know your patients, meaning some tools are much, much better for people who've had a high school education and a Western education. And some tools are much, much better for people who have lower educational attainment or maybe we're educated in another country. So for example, in San Francisco, we see a lot of folks who had a few years of education in a rural area in Central America. And we just don't want to use the same tools. Brains are somewhat individual organs and very complex. And so we don't want to be overly blunt in the application of tools. We also need to think more broadly about dementia, that it's really a condition that affects cognition and function. So what we teach and what we do in practice is we screen briefly for cognition, briefly for functional impairment as well. And then we screen for the presence of a support system, like a caregiver or someone in their lives. And we try to do all of those things relatively quickly with the goal of setting everybody on this clinical path of we need to pay attention to the cognitive functioning, the ability to function in daily life, and who's in their life, who's their support system. Because these are also the things that we're going to be managing and supporting throughout clinical care of the condition. That was my long way of saying I do typically use a tool called the MiniCOG because it's really short and it tends to be less biased in diverse populations. It's like three words that you ask the person to remember and then they draw a clock. And so it's really doable. And then unfortunately, I could talk all day about all the other tools, so I will spare you. But I think a simple approach that anyone as a clinician feels comfortable quickly assessing cognition, function, and support system is a good way to broadly screen for both a condition and how you're going to work with the patient and support them.
You mentioned that a lot of your patients experience delays to diagnosis, that sometimes they go in to be seen for symptoms and then kind of nothing happens for 3 months, or they might even get a diagnosis and then nothing really happens. Can you talk about this? Like, what are the barriers or problems that patients and families are facing as they move through this dementia evaluation?
There is truly study after study showing that we just do not detect this condition early enough. Unfortunately, there's also studies that show that almost half of people will never get a diagnosis. They will never know that they were living with this condition. That does not to say it was not affecting them or their life or their health or their financial well-being and all these things. So we are doing a really pretty poor job in medicine right now of doing early detection, comprehensive diagnosis, good care support. I think the way to make it doable is at the moment of screening, start some of these interventions because you want that person to be getting that good brain health care early on. And then I don't think it's actually a bad thing that it may take some time to get to diagnosis because it is a complex condition and we want to make sure we feel comfortable with the information we have. I think also to understand why it's so complicated. It's partly so complicated because it's especially rare to diagnose in the mild stages. And the reason for that is it's milder, not to make too obvious a point, but people will not have as many symptoms and they can get brushed aside or the person may not mention it. As I mentioned, people don't screen mostly in healthcare. We don't screen in most settings. So with milder symptoms, it's going to be harder to nail down exactly what's going on. And then the diagnostics we have are rapidly evolving, yes, in terms of like what kind of labs and what kind of imaging is going to tell us what's really going on. But it is a diagnosis where we gather a lot of information and we make a clinical diagnosis. So we don't have a slam dunk lab or imaging study that tells us with every person. We literally go and we triangulate the information. We get a very good history, which takes time. We have to get collateral information because often the person isn't aware of all their symptoms or may not really be able to report super accurately about what they've been experiencing. We get diagnostics that are appropriate, some labs, some imaging. And then if available, we might get more in-depth, what we call neuropsychological or cognitive testing. I always explain to patients that it's like, I can listen to your heart, I can listen to your lungs, I can't really listen to your brain to hear how it's doing. We're going to test all these discrete things your brain does and see how it's doing. Neuropsychological testing in the hands of a very good clinician could certainly potentially be pretty diagnostic. But even then, we usually don't have a point of comparison for that person. So the clinical concept is dementia is a new decline in cognition that is affecting day-to-day function. On the side of the cognitive function, because we usually don't have everybody's test scores from early on, we have to compare it to what we would call a normal sample. And I know this is a little in the weeds, but I think the take home there is, who are we comparing this to? Do we have information about normal controls, people who don't have dementia but are the same age, roughly the same education level? Do they match this person we're seeing? So we really need to know who we're comparing it to. So like in my clinic, we make sure that we're comparing people with a background from Central America whose primary language might be Spanish to a similar set of tests that were compared to normal controls in that group. Same thing with people from Asia. Same thing with people who primarily were raised speaking English or in a Western society. It's a little more complicated than just doing a quick test, and I think that's one of the challenges. However, despite all those challenges, what I'm really trying to emphasize in the work I get to do clinically and with colleagues, and even in some of the education work I do, is actually that the criteria for the syndrome are easier than all that. What all that is trying to give us is also an arrow pointing in the direction of what is the underlying cause. So dementia is a syndrome of someone with progressive cognitive decline and progressive functional decline. But what we really don't know just by figuring that out is what is causing it. So we know there are certain common causes like Alzheimer's disease, but it takes someone with some clinical experience to figure out that next part as well. So could it be frontal temporal dementia? Could it be Lewy body dementia? Is it Alzheimer's disease causing this syndrome? So I think you want your clinical team to be doing a good and thorough job trying to find all these pieces of information and come to a clinical diagnosis. And then when and if possible, asking, is there more information we can get to figure out what could be causing this? And part of the reason I say that is I think more and more people are encountering that across the country, some clinical centers are starting to offer more specific Alzheimer's disease testing, which is one cause of dementia syndrome. And that's going to be something that's added to our toolbox really soon here in the near future, because it's really starting to, I think, be integrated into practice in more places.
I'm struck by how comprehensive and in-depth you are answering these questions. And hearing you talk, I'm imagining that you have 60 minutes with every patient to do all these things. And we know that primary care is under strain, visits are short, time is limited, and you are able to lean on specialists, on consultants to help you manage the care of your patients. And that includes neurology and in some cases, dementia experts. Talk for a moment about what that collaboration is like. How are you usually interfacing with patients and families and their other doctors, like the neurologists?
I really love my job in part because I feel like I'm sitting on a fence between all these groups. I guess it would be a very geometrically complicated fence, but there's patients and families on one side who fortunately I spend my most time with. And then there's hyper specialists, behavioral neurologists, neuropsychologists on the other side. And then there's primary care. And I really see myself as serving all of these folks because as geriatrician treating dementia, I really do get to look at the whole person, really assess the whole person and their caregiver, their support system, and try to bridge this conversation between everybody. And so what I would be saying to the primary care provider is, what do you know about their cognition? What do you know about their function? And the key things here are trajectory. What have you learned in your history? It doesn't have to be everything about everything, but what has changed and how has it changed and how fast is it changing? These are all really big clues on whether or not dementia is something that's happening. For the neurologists, I'm trying to give them much more specific information and work with them and get an understanding of what parts of their cognition are they noticing or struggling, because that gives us these clues to what is the underlying disease that's causing it. Why do we care if really a lot of the overall management is supportive? And as I was saying earlier, it should be very supportive. It should be very active in that regard. What the neurologists are looking for is, do I see a pattern that suggests it's more Alzheimer's, more Lewy body, more frontal temporal? And the reason is because that would potentially tell you more about what symptoms to expect and also trajectory and prognosis. And the treatments might be slightly different for some of the symptoms. So it is really important. And that's what they're trying to zero in on. In addition, for many neurologists, like just cinch the diagnosis of yes, is definitely dementia, as opposed to severe sleep apnea and depression playing a role and things like that. And then for patients and families, I really like to just repeat and review everything that we've learned. We've noticed these symptoms, or you were telling us about these symptoms. You need more support in these ways in the last few years. These things are going on. We got the brain scan and it looks normal, which actually would suggest that this really could still be underlying Alzheimer's disease, or we saw a lot of this and that suggests there may be some vascular disease that is causing your symptoms. And here's the things we should be working on to make sure your brain is doing as well as it can for as long as it can, and how we're going to support you and plan for the future. I always tell patients and families, one, I'm going to ask a lot of questions that seem really nosy about your life, because I really want to understand how you get through a day and the kind of things you do and enjoy doing. And then I also say, I'm going to say a lot of really boring things and you're going to wonder why I'm saying them, but I really want to make sure you have the tools you need going forward to plan with your support system, to get resources. And so I think with neurologists, if they're accessible, really they can be extremely helpful to put all those pieces together in a way that says dementia plus minus these other things or not, and what's the underlying cause. But I think if we don't have access to those specialists, we can still go really, really far, even if it's small bits over various visits, understanding that person's cognitive symptoms and trajectory and their functional symptoms and trajectory. And I think most primaries are really, really good at looking for other causes, like I mentioned, like sleep apnea or a thyroid condition, things like that. And once all that's ruled out, it gets more and more likely that the dementia is what's causing this decline. And it is one of my missions to be able to support people who really don't have providers and clinics that really don't have the specialty support, and to help them gain the skills and confidence to work with patients on dementia. Because the default would be, okay, well, I don't really feel comfortable diagnosing this. I can't get them into the neurologist, or there isn't one in this area that's really specialized in this. And that the person just experiences a delay that just goes on and on. And I think with the numbers of people in our aging population, that's just not a future we want.
Yeah, that's a good reality check that by no means does every single patient have access to the Stanford Brain Center or whatever hyper specialists there is. Sometimes we have to make do with the resources that we have. I'm wondering about living situation. So as dementia progresses, we have a mild phase, we have a moderate phase, we have a severe phase. At some point along that journey, decisions need to be made about where is this person safest, where is this person best served. And in my mind, there's three categories. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but number one is care in the home. And so usually there's somebody there caring for them, whether that's a family member or a hired caregiver. Then I think about an assisted living facility where there's still some independence, but you're in a community and there's some built-in support. And then I think about something like a nursing home where it's really a more medical environment with nurses and so on and so forth. Can you break each of these down and talk more about the differences between them and which patients and families are best served by which, and how do you know where the right place is for you?
I don't know if it's fair to say, but sometimes it seems like there's a popular notion that at some point you're at the point where it's time. And I don't even want to say this phrase, but put mom in a home. Somehow that's going to be obvious. I think that this is such an individual decision, and there's nothing clinically that says someone needs to be not in their home. They definitely need the right support, but there's no theoretical reason that that can't be provided in the home. However, there's a lot of practical reasons, and that's just going to vary so much between people. So I guess all I mean to say is, and I think it was in Being Mortal by Atul Gawande, he really went over how the nursing homes even got started. And bottom line, it was for the convenience of nurses, not for the dedication of the health industrial complex in general to the well-being of frail older people. 80% of people in nursing homes have dementia, so it is certainly a common place that people with dementia will experience at some point in their life because of the functional concerns. But the general rule of thumb is people with more day-to-day, what we call activities of daily living disabilities, meaning they need help for things like bathing, toileting, dressing, feeding. Those sorts of disabilities will often exceed the capacity of family caregivers and even the ability of a family to pay for caregivers to come and help that person. And that is probably the greatest strength of a skilled nursing facility, is to have that support. I think it's worth knowing, though, that skilled nursing facilities, these are not at the level of hospitals. They really, state by state, might have different requirements on staffing levels. And it's really actually the certified nursing assistants, the bedside caregivers, that are doing the bulk of the care. It's just to be aware that nursing ratios and staff ratios are a really, really big question to keep in mind when you're looking at a place like that if you want. But that's a general rule of thumb about skilled nursing facilities, is people usually have two or more activities of daily living disabilities. Assisted living is a more amorphous space. It's sort of combining a home and a caregiver in a more, let's say, efficient setting for getting more people access to caregiver services. But that could be provided in the home. And this is where everything really comes down to individual resources. And in my case, I'm almost always working with folks who have our state Medicaid program, Medi-Cal, and that just has certain options for paying for caregivers that other states may or may not have the same level of service from that program. And then everybody above that limit has to pay out of pocket. And for a lot of people, that becomes prohibitive pretty quickly. And it's variable if an assisted living will take healthcare dollars. Skilled nursing facilities often take healthcare dollars at some point in that person's stay, right after a hospitalization usually. They'll take Medicare, and then at some point they may take Medicaid. But again, it really depends on that person's circumstances, and a lot of people have to spend down their personal assets in a skilled nursing facility. So I realize I'm mixing like clinical and healthcare payment and things like that, but I cannot emphasize enough how not a system this is basically. It's really a mix of just availability of beds, what the person needs, what resources they have, what they want. And that's how people end up in different places. And I wish I could say it was a particularly strategic or thought out process for everybody. But unfortunately, it often ends up on the burden of the person, whoever is supporting them, to figure it out. And I think we should normalize people wanting to stay at home. I think that for many people, the preferred way that they want to live with dementia is in their home. And for many people, that means hiring a caregiver, looking for a state-supported program that can provide a caregiver. And there's a lot of other interesting programs, though, out there. There's home-based primary care, which can help people stay at home longer so they get access to medical care in their home. That would be like getting your primary care doctor, not necessarily a caregiver. There's the Program for All-Inclusive Care of the Elderly, which is expanding like crazy all over the country. And that is meant to substitute nursing homes. So it's really for very frail people who have these disabilities and activities of daily living. But they combine all your health and caregiver services in a bundle. And their entire goal, their entire focus is to keep you at home as long as possible. And if you can't, they work out where you go next. So very often they also run assisted livings or they have contracts with nursing facilities, but that's absolutely not their goal. Their goal is to make sure you're as comfortable in your home as long as possible. So I find that a lot of my patients really want to explore that option if it works with their overall situation. So I hope that was as clear as it is in real life. but I think a lot of people just come to a decision, personal or with some intervention of family, that because of whatever resources they have among themselves, their families, financially, all those things, that the next step is to consolidate care in an assisted living or a skilled nursing facility and then look for one of those. But there isn't, other than a general sense that people at home are the most independent and people in a skilled nursing facility are the least, it's not a law of physics. It's a very flexible and kind of influx system.
So let's say there's a family who is no longer able to manage at home, and they're beginning to look for some kind of facility, whether it's assisted living or a nursing facility. You mentioned nursing ratios as something to ask about. What else should they be looking for, both on the positive side, like things to look for, and then maybe red flags, things that they want to ask about so that they can rule out those places?
I want to really emphasize that obviously this is a huge decision and it's a big responsibility for the facility to take on the support and care of somebody who, just to make a broad assumption, has some vulnerabilities and really needs support. So big, big picture, really look for a place that takes those responsibilities seriously and really seems to care about their residents. There's so many resources out there. So there is a checklist that the National Institutes on Aging puts out, like things to look for. It's really just to point out just how big a responsibility this is. It's a really long checklist. So I think everybody could probably find 5 or 10 questions on there that they think is really important to ask any place. It probably goes without saying, like taking a tour, not just looking at a website, but really seeing what the place is like, experiencing it. It's going to be this person's home. So is it a place that this person would want to call home? Obviously, the spectrum of choice that they're going to have is going to vary. Maybe there's 2 places that fit their budget. Maybe there's 10. So there will be differences in choice. But which one is more feels like that person and you think they would be more comfortable in? I think personal recommendations, there probably couldn't be any better gauge. So if somebody's had a family member or a loved one in a place and they really thought they got good care, that's really important. Different categories of places are licensed by different state or federal agencies. So a nursing home has a different set of places they report to than the assisted living in our state is usually licensed by our Department of Social Services, which just goes to show you how not medical it is. Whereas our nursing homes are licensed by Medicare, kind of sort of, and our Department of Public Health at the level of the state. And so what is the report on this place? Have there been any complaints? We want to kind of flip-flop between the nice things and the important things, like just basic safety and violations. And this is going to sound kind of like a weird thing, but increasingly private equity is buying up a lot of these places. Unfortunately, the data has not looked very good about the outcomes when they take over a place. So is there any way to find out if this is a place owned by a private equity company? For obvious reasons, they have a stronger emphasis on profit over people, is the theory there. A lot of my colleagues, when I was training, they said, you go and you honestly, you just peek into rooms they're not showing you. You ask to go to a floor they didn't plan to show you. Maybe you do your research ahead of time. Oh, you have a gym, you have a yoga center. Can I see that if they didn't show you? One of my colleagues also said, use your nose. Does it smell like people are well cared for? Does it smell like people have potentially been neglected with regard to their personal hygiene? As I'm saying all this and maybe seeming to cast aspersions on these places, they play a critical role in caring for some of our most vulnerable people in society. And I just want to emphasize how hard it is for the staff as well. So many places, particularly if they're understaffed, the staff are really usually well-intentioned and trying. They're just under-resourced. It's similar to all aspects of care and childcare and senior care and all these things. It's like we just don't have enough people doing the work. And this is the most human work on earth. Some places will tout memory care or certain features. And I think you really want to ask, what does that mean? Is that a certification? What do you mean by memory care? Are people trained extra? Or do you literally just have a unit that you call the memory care unit, which is frankly the case in some places? It's sort of akin to gourmet coffee in New York City. It's just words they put on the pamphlet. I just want to acknowledge how absolutely hard this is because it's a new home for somebody. We don't have all the choices we'd like to have very often. It tends to be a lot of money. And yet it's really hard to figure out if it's the right place. Then I think because of that, the last thing I would put on the list to ask is, what happens if this doesn't work out? What if my mom really doesn't want to be here? We don't feel comfortable with her being in here anymore. Let's say she moved in with one of us for a little while. Would she be able to come back if things changed? In 6 months, it was a better fit for her after that. Because I've seen some folks, unfortunately, make those decisions. And then there was some stipulation in the contract that that meant they could never come back to that place if they voluntarily withdrew their loved one. So really looking at the contract before you sign it and really being aware of what the implications are. This is unfortunately a lot of work. It really is. It's a big move, and it's something to research and to be prepared on some level and to know what your most important features are.
You mentioned that some places advertise a memory care unit. Can you talk more about facilities that either do specialize or claim to specialize in dementia? Are there facilities that are specifically dedicated to dementia, or is it more, like you said, a wing of the facility that's for dementia? And what would a legit certification look like or entail? Are these locked units because the patients have more of a tendency to wander? Do the nursing staff have special skills in dealing with behavioral outbursts and things of that nature? Like, what raises the bar to actually this is tailored to a dementia population?
So of course, especially with the fact that we're talking about folks living with dementia, memory care is going to be a potential consideration or something that you're thinking about, especially if a place advertises it. And again, I would just really zero in on, what do you mean by that? Does this mean that people have extra training, or is there actually a certification? Because depending on where you live in the country, that might be differently handled. Are the staffing ratios more? I think really that's a key question, because I actually have seen some locked units. And the reason they usually will lock a unit is because the people on that unit can still walk fairly well. And as we know, some people get symptoms of wandering or will get lost. Understandably, they don't want the risk of the person leaving without them knowing. Many people with dementia don't walk as well or have stopped walking in the more advanced stages. And so that may not be necessary. So the question is, like, what's the balance of that? The other really big questions have to do around behavior. So do your staff have more training in behaviors, particularly maybe more aggressive behaviors? How are those handled? And I think there's some amount of federal reporting that all these places have to do on their use of medications for what sometimes is called agitation or aggression. And some places are very dedicated to minimizing that. That is overall better for the health of the person living with dementia to not have these medications. Sometimes, understandably, they're necessary, but they become more and more necessary when places aren't staffed appropriately because there's not enough people to redirect the person, calm them down, separate them from others. And so I've seen some places that are really, really dedicated to this, not medicating people with medications for agitation, have 3 to 4 times the staff ratio. Again, these are pretty rare places, but they really dedicate themselves to being, you can almost think of it as the ICU level stage sometimes for people with dementia, that they really need that extra support, that extra person. It's a person level intervention. It's not just a medication. So there's a lot of work being done to improve the use of these medications and to encourage higher staffing ratios. So for you in particular, looking at a place, tell me about the memory unit. Does it have higher staff? What's your use of antipsychotics or other medications for agitation? Is that something you try to minimize, or how do you handle that? And then to some degree, there may be some reporting, or people may have reported the place for using more of those medications than not if they were concerned about it. So I would look for that in the reports. I think the other thing about memory care is just seeing if people are out, about, active, if they're being engaged, as opposed to everybody in their room looking very quiet, because really it's about what engages us, not if we can be engaged. And then some places I think are really proactive as well about music therapy, and that tends to be a really powerful and really positive program for people with dementia, really any older adult, but in people with dementia, it's another, I think, sign that they're really trying, they're really showing that they're trying to engage their residents and give them a higher quality of life.
I want to ask about patients who are living at home, but who go to a daycare program, almost the same way a child would go to daycare during the day. Sometimes this is called adult daycare. Can you tell us about what this is and how it works and how to think about that?
There's so many programs, it almost gets confusing sometimes, but there's different categories of programs. There's a lot of programs in the community that are focused on older adults, and they're free or very low cost, and they're senior centers or museum programs or all the things that people really give discounts to seniors or open up free to seniors. So again, anything that's stimulating is going to be really, really good for the brain. And I know our art museums here in San Francisco have programs for people with disabilities, including dementia. But then there's a category of programs that are considered more formal, and sometimes health insurance will pay for it. Again, specifically things like Medicaid. And these will be called adult day health. And they have a little bit of medical support as well. They often also offer transportation. They tend to be for people who have additional disabilities, meaning functional disabilities, like what I was referring to with the nursing home eligibility, that they have a functional need. And the goal is specifically with these programs to reduce the likelihood that they're going to go into a facility or need that level of support. So they're meant to be stimulating like physical therapy, occupational therapy, oriented activities, and food. And then there's a nurse there if the person needs medications or if something goes on. And then again, the transportation is usually included. And these can be really great programs, really stimulating. The other way I think about it is it often provides a break for a caregiver. So anything that I can find and engage the person living with dementia to do and want to do, particularly without their caregiver, I always think of as like additional respite and an additional resource for everybody in that family or in that unit of people. But I just want to emphasize, I think sometimes, despite the diversity of people as they age, we sometimes like to assume that they all want to do the same thing or that they're all going to want to do this program that we came up with that's so great. And I really try to leave space for and normalize, like, some people, it's just not their thing. They're just not going to want to go. If they're resistant, because with dementia, sometimes people do have what we call amotivation. They just stop wanting to engage with things. I will try to support the caregiver to encourage them to go maybe with the caregiver a couple times. And then after the person feels comfortable going to the program, the caregiver can back out. And I always frame things as a trial, like just try it. It may not be the world's greatest thing, but you should try it. And at least you know you don't like it as opposed to not even trying it. But I think in general, finding something that that person wants to do to engage the brain and that they really enjoy, be that a free program, a Tai Chi class in the park, a museum program even once a month, or the whole kit and caboodle with like a big program, all could be great. So this is where, after going through this with folks, definitely I've had many patients and their families think I was the social worker by the end of visit, forgot that we started with a medical visit, because I really spend a lot of time on this. It's super, super important. This probably does vary somewhat by state, but these programs are typically part of what we call like our area agencies on aging. They often support and make sure that these programs are operational. And I would say the offerings for older adults is better than what's out there publicly for kids. There's a lot more. And the Forgotten Older Americans Act, which was approved with our other safety net program acts like Medicare to support older adults. And this is a mandated, well, this is where my lack of legal expertise comes in, but this is a legislated entity that supports older adults in the community. So there's so much to take advantage of.
When you look 5-10 years in the future, what are your wishes for dementia care? What do you wish could be different or better?
Wow, that's such a generous question, because I have so much I'd like to say. The most important thing at the end of the day is that people who are living with dementia, getting a diagnosis, and the people who are in their lives supporting them feel seen and feel supported in a really meaningful way. And we have a lot of work to do on that front. But my biggest hope in the short term, the 5-year term, would be that we accept in healthcare that we need to screen and detect early, and that we need to be supporting brain health as early as possible. That could, frankly, be a public health intervention. It doesn't always have to come on the heels of screening and detection. But I want to give people the biggest, longest chance possible to live with the healthiest brain that they can at any one time. And then I think the bigger picture is that people, when they encounter us in healthcare, that they feel like they received clear information about what's going on, that their symptoms have been assessed and addressed, and that they have a plan. It's really just that simple. This is not a complicated thing, but it can at times feel like a bit of a moonshot. And this is probably one of the saddest things I've learned in starting to do more and more dementia care, is that a lot of patients describe their experience as adios and diagnose. And that right there is the lesion, that people feel like they get information that they have this diagnosis, but then they don't really get that plan. So my biggest hope is that everybody leaves feeling able to just spend time understanding the diagnosis and how they feel about that without also worrying about everything else that comes along with it and having to figure it out for themselves. And that extends 100% to the caregiver as well.
Well, I just want to thank you, Anna, for coming in and speaking with me today about your experience caring for people with dementia through the lens of geriatrics. It's really wonderful to hear how you think about this. It's a different flavor than from the neurologist or the neuropsych. It's, like I said, really focused on the whole picture. And I'm just grateful that you brought your expertise to Remo today.
Thank you for having me and for all you guys are doing.
Thank you for listening. For more information about this episode, check out the links and resources listed in the show notes. If you're interested in learning more from Remo, visit us at www.remo.health. Take care.